Tech Talk with Jess Kelly. This is News Talk.
Very welcome along to Tech Talk. This is Jess Kelly with you here on News Talk. Coming up this week, we'll hear why Clubhouse is a bit of a headache when it comes to data protection. Plus, we'll learn how smart meters could save you money. As always, you can email the show techtalk@newstalk.com or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. On Tuesday of this week, I was on the Pat Kenny Show and I was there talking about this new app that's created quite a bit of hype, particularly around famous people and people in the tech space. It's called Clubhouse. If you missed the explainer as to what it is, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com or just search for technology on the Pat Kenny Show wherever you get your podcasts. But I tweeted out asking people if they're on it. And one person got back to me saying no, and they are concerned about some of the data protection elements of this app. And I'm delighted to say he joins me now, Dara O'Brien from Castlebridge. Dara, welcome back to the show. What are your concerns when it comes to Clubhouse?
Oh, my concerns are many and varied, Jess. The first concern I have is that when I go into the detail of my concerns, this will make some more sense. But the first concern I have is that after all the kerfuffle we had last year about Zoom, it looks like the promoters and founders of Clubhouse haven't actually learned anything about where the world is now in terms of people's attitude to data protection and what the laws that exist around the world actually are in terms of what you can do. Clubhouse's model for onboarding customers is basically the same approach that Facebook started off with back in 2007, 2008. And from there, the issues kind of snowball. So the first thing is their model for getting people on board. It's all exclusive. You only get onto Clubhouse if you're invited, which is fantastic. But the first problem with that is that your Clubhouse profile, if you join, shows who invited you.
Is that not a good thing from a transparency point of view, though?
That's a huge problem from a the fact that you don't know that's going to happen is part of the problem.
Okay.
And also, to register for Clubhouse, you have to give it permission to access your address book and contacts, and then it starts building a list and a profile of who are the most popular people on Clubhouse in terms of the number of users who are accessing, but also it's building a profile of all the people who aren't on Clubhouse and showing the relationships between those, again, building a nudge factor effect in terms of how people might be encouraged to join Clubhouse. So that pooling of data to rank you and to rank your suitability in the club, so to speak, is a key problem. And that invite a friend scheme, from an EU data protection law perspective, we've got case law that says invite a friend schemes just are not compatible with EU law because you can't give consent on behalf of your friend for the processing of their data. And that's why those upload your contact list approaches to getting users, to getting user growth at scale, are problematic from a data protection perspective.
Okay, this is bad from my side, right? But I signed up on Tuesday after I was on the PK show, and I just did that thing that I'm always telling people not to do, which is hit yes, 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 accept yes, whatever you need, absolutely twice, there's no problem. And I saw that exact thing of names from my phone book appearing within the app, asking me, did I want to invite them? And then it now says on my profile who referred me to Clubhouse, and anyone that I refer will then be mentioned on their profile. So you're saying that fundamental thing of, you know, having your name, for example, appear on Clubhouse as someone that I should invite, that's just not okay from a data protection point of view.
That's not okay from a data protection point of view. And also the simple thing of there are people in your contact list who you mightn't ever want to be connected with outside of your contact list. I've got numbers on my contact list of phone numbers that I've blocked, people who I never want to hear from. But in order to block them, I have to have them in my contact list. And this is one of the challenges with these sorts of onboarding processes where you don't have control over how your data is being used and who it's being displayed to. The other key challenge within kind of that onboarding process and how Clubhouse is processing your data is they talk about in their terms and conditions about inferring your preferences based off of various things. Now, once you're into that area of inferring preferences, you're into data profiling under Article 22 of GDPR, and that's problematic, particularly when they're talking about using the content of your communications, because processing the content of communications is actually in breach of the European Electronic Communications Code and the e-privacy directives. Clubhouse, if I was to draw a picture of it, has a lot of fire coming out of the roof from a data protection perspective.
How can they get away with it then? Because as you mentioned at the top, you know, it's not a million miles away from what Facebook did at the beginning. But then we had the whole Cambridge Analytica thing, which opened a lot of people's eyes to how data sharing and data collating works. So if we've learned that lesson, how is Clubhouse getting away with it?
It's not that they're getting away with it. The first thing is that it's all with any new thing, there's always hype. The fact that there's celebrities using it, the fact that there's a peer pressure and hype cycle around getting on board, and the FOMO effect, the fear of missing out, means that sometimes people aren't looking at these things critically initially. Also, it's fair for people to think that if we've had all of the scrutiny in the past, new tools and technologies that are coming to the market will have thought about these issues and learned from the lessons of the past. Clubhouse seems to have looked at what people did in the past and said, no, it's okay, we'll ignore that and just do it our way anyway. They're based in the US, which means that there's US data protection laws, such as they are, apply. But even in that, they may have issues from the point of view of the state of California and some of the state level laws in the US that are emerging. And that's the challenge. It's the global regulatory aspects in terms of who will they be accountable to, and the fact that it takes time for regulators to formulate a position and to have a problem child such as Clubhouse in their sights. Inevitably, I suspect they'll wind up setting up a European headquarters in Ireland, in which case there'll be the Data Protection Commissioner's problem, which means that things like announcing that their data spillage wasn't a data breach when it absolutely is a data breach under EU law and indeed US law, will become a problem for Clubhouse once they're sitting firmly in the sights of a European regulator.
As it stands today, obviously I'm an Irish citizen, I'm a European citizen. If I wanted, could I complain to the Irish DPC about my Clubhouse experience thus far, even though I haven't had any massive issues, but information has been uploaded to the site and there are elements, as you outlined there, that perhaps weren't as spelled out to the user as they could be?
The issue, Jess, is that the DPC, you can complain to them, but there might be an awful lot they can do, given that they have no direct, because Clubhouse isn't based in Ireland yet, they don't have a European point of presence, that, as far as I'm aware. So if they were established in Europe, in any of the other European member states, the Data Protection Commission could refer that complaint on to one of their peer regulators. But internationally, things become a little bit more complicated for the DPC, and there are limits to what they can do from a regulatory enforcement perspective. They might listen to you and agree that it's a mess, but there might be a challenge for what they can actually do, other than raise awareness of the fact that there are fundamental laws here, whether or not you have had an impact or whether it feels you're having a negative experience as a user. There are actual rules and laws and regulations here that are being broken by the application. In the same way as you might feel perfectly happy speeding from one place to the other on the motorway, that might be fine and you might feel personally okay with that. There's still laws being broken.
And so in terms of the Clubhouse model, and if they wanted to go about it, is it just a case that they couldn't do what they're doing within the different data protection regulations? In order for them to comply, they would have to change the model of what they're trying to achieve.
And that's the key thing, Jess. In order to comply, they'll have to change what they're doing. Their model, the way in which they're approaching the security model, the privacy by design approach that most applications, even God bless us, Zoom has had to learn over the last year how to improve their game in this place, in that context. Clubhouse would have to realign and readjust their model. Now, with an oil tanker the size of Facebook, it takes regulators time to get them to pivot and change. Facebook has had the benefit of over a decade of slightly less onerous regulation in this area. Clubhouse is landing into the market with a business model and approach that was questionable in 2009, dealing with 2021 legislation and regulation.
For anyone listening to this, and they may be like, oh, will you two calm down? Because I'm always going on about data protection. You're always going on about data protection. Can you give some context as to why this matters and why people should care that this is happening?
The reason people should care, Jess, is that if an organization that's looking to give you, that's looking to get you to give them their data, isn't in a position to explain clearly what is going to happen with that information, and isn't in a position to design their product or service in a way that colors within the lines of what the law actually is, not what they might want it to be, you then have to wonder what is happening with that data. How secure is it? You might find the issue with what they're calling a data spillage, which was a user using the capability of the app to download recordings of messages and conversations that people believed were private. That's an example of the law requiring a particular approach to be taken to securing the processing of data and it not being done. And that means that for you as an individual, if you have an abusive ex, if you have a dodgy past, if you have dodgy friends who you don't want your other friends to know that you know, having that information displayed, having that information shared and made accessible, because you're on the app or on the platform, has an impact on your how you interact with other people in the world. And also, who has access to that data on the back end of the application? What are they learning about you, about who your friends are, about what you say, what you do, what messages you send and receive, are all very, very important elements of your person online and how you interact with things. WhatsApp, very famously bought for $19 billion by Facebook. WhatsApp was bought by Facebook to have access to the information about who was messaging who, how often. And we've seen them change their terms and conditions for WhatsApp for everywhere outside of Europe to enable them to gain access to that information much more easily, to integrate that with Facebook for marketing and advertising purposes. In Europe, the Irish Data Protection Commissioner drew a line in the sand and said that that could not be done. And as of today, it would appear that Facebook have not come and asked the DPC for any change in that position.
At what stage does individual user responsibility come into play? Because I mentioned there when I set up my account, I don't know why, because I'm usually meticulous with all this sort of stuff. I just hit, yeah, whatever, that's grand. You know, should the responsibility not be on me to question what's happening with my data and be a bit more responsible when it comes to signing up to these services if they don't appear to be adhering to the different regulations that are in place?
I think that the way I'd answer that question, Jess, is are you responsible for making sure that your microwave oven doesn't blow up? And the answer is that you're not as a user. You're entitled to assume and to act on the basis that your microwave oven has been designed and built in line with the standards and requirements for safety legislation and the regulations around microwave ovens. In the same way, an app like this, yes, there's a certain level of personal responsibility to familiarize yourself with the deal you're getting into and having a look through what might be done with your data. But the onus is actually on the producer of the application, the organization building the technology, building the tools to tell you what's happening and to design their product in a way that gives effect to and supports those rights to data protection and data privacy that we enjoy. It's the concept known as data protection by design in the GDPR, or privacy by design is the more general international term, where in the same way as your microwave oven or your car are not designed for you to have to know how to make sure they don't blow up on you. They're designed to run and operate, and you can trust that they're not going to blow up on you because they've been designed properly and they've been built properly. The issue here is the same, that we're now at a point where it's increasingly not acceptable and shouldn't be acceptable for app developers to ignore what the regulations and rules are around how they can use data and how they need to build their apps securely.
So we have GDPR here in Europe, and it's, you know, I know I always get slagged in here because I love it, but I do actually think it's one of the best things to happen. Now, that's only when it's properly enforced, but I do think it's a good thing for us, the consumer. Is there a way to have a universal approach to privacy, user privacy, when it comes to technology? I was at the launch of the last government's plan for internet safety, and Leo Varadkar, who was a Taoiseach at the time, said, you know, given its very nature, it's the World Wide Web. So it's very difficult for us to police it here in Ireland when it is something that's so ubiquitous. It's everywhere. So is there a way that we could try to tackle this so that it's not one rule for Europe and another for the States and another for Asia and so on?
Well, since the 1980s, there's actually been an international treaty on data protection called Convention 108 of the Council of Europe. That's different to the European Union. It's a much broader, larger organization. And that sets out a number of fundamental principles that it's recently been updated to align with GDPR. And what we're seeing around the world in sub-Saharan Africa, in Asia, we're seeing the emergence of data protection laws that are modeled on and align with European data protection norms and data protection standards. In the US, we're seeing at state level, we're seeing California basically with essentially a variant of GDPR. We're seeing Virginia in the last week passing a data protection law that is very similar to the Californian law and very similar to GDPR in terms of what it requires organizations to do. So while the internet, it's easy for politicians to paint the internet as being the Wild West, but international cooperation and international standard development is something we need to do across a whole host of areas, and data protection is just one of them. And there are framework standards and example standards out there, and there are international treaties that their countries can subscribe to that provide a common baseline standard that we can start building on together. And we're beginning to see that there's a significant number of countries around the world now have at national level a data protection law. And when we look at the US, we're seeing increasing solidification at state level around data protection laws, even if we don't have them at a federal level yet.
So would your bottom line be that we should steer clear of Clubhouse until they get their house in order?
My bottom line is, if I was buying a physical house that looked like Clubhouse, I'd be very concerned about subsidence and the roof falling in. And from that point of view, until the team behind Clubhouse actually start talking to the media about the issues that have been raised, because that's, again, another concern. With Zoom, at least they came out and they responded very early and they engaged. Clubhouse have not engaged, other than to deny that they had a data breach and call it a spillage. Should we avoid them? I think yes. Personally, I wouldn't touch them with a barge pole at the moment, but other people can make their own choices. But it's important that you make informed choices and you educate yourself as to what the issues are and what the actual legal situation is around what Clubhouse is doing and why it is not colouring within the lines.
Okay, so that's a stark warning there, a piece of advice. And before I let you go, I want to ask you a little bit about the Data Protection Commission here in Ireland. They released their annual report. There was a hell of a lot of stats within it. I know Helen Dixon, the commissioner, was on with Pat Kenny on Thursday. Was there anything that jumped out at you from that report?
A couple of things jumped out at me from the report. First of all, the sheer volume of work the DPC does cannot be underestimated and cannot be understated. Their level of complaints has gone up 9% from last year, which shows that people are more aware of their rights and they're actually engaging to try and give effect to their rights. The big thing that jumped out at me was the complexity of the large big tech cross-border multi-regulator investigations, where the DPC has draft decisions that are communicated to their colleagues in the European Data Protection Board, all the other data protection regulators in Europe, and then there's a delay of a number of months in the actual final decision arising. Hopefully that is down to the procedural issues needing to be ironed out about that cooperation mechanism in GDPR, and we'll begin to see an increased pace of enforcement. Because that's what we need. It's not huge fines. It's regular, consistent, and predictable enforcement to encourage startup companies to think about data protection by design when they're putting their ideas together. Mm. So we don't wind up with more apps like Clubhouse.
Yeah, absolutely. It all comes together in a neat little bow. Dara O'Brien of Castlebridge, thanks so much for joining us here on News Talk.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you'd like to get in touch with the programme, or you'll find me on Twitter at JessKellyNT. On Thursday evening, Sony PlayStation held an event called The State of Play. this was something that a lot of gamers were quite excited about. And I know the gamer that I live with came away slightly disappointed. But joining me now to talk through what they announced and what we can expect in the coming months is John Riley, editor of TheEffect.net. John, how are you?
Good, Jess. How are you?
I'm grand now. So for those who don't know, explain a little bit about State of Play. What were we expecting and then what did we get?
Yeah, so State of Play is basically like Sony's online version of a press conference, really. I think, you know, the last couple of years they've been shying away from the big actual in-person events, the likes of E3 in the States. Even prior to COVID and all that, they just kind of wasn't their thing. But these State of Plays now, I think there's one or eighth one now, or ninth or something. And it's basically like a trailer showcase of games coming to both the PS4 and the PS5 over the coming months and years even. So last night's one came out of the blue somewhat. I think they announced it on Tuesday and then obviously it happened on Thursday. And yeah, I think they said from the get-go that there wasn't going to be any hardware kind of announcements or any kind of hardware showcase pieces because there was talk about the PSVR, the new edition. But This one really did focus on just titles coming to the both our new console and then also, as I said, to the PS4 for those, you know, people that are still having difficulty getting their hands on one of the PS5s.
Yeah, like, so one of the things when the PS5 and the new Xbox came out before Christmas, you and I were talking, and one of the things that I think we both said was, this will be amazing when we get the new games to kind of, like, when we see the full potential of the console with some of the newer games. What did we get from PlayStation on Thursday evening? Was there anything that made you kind of sit up going, ooh, this is the one I'm waiting for?
I think from the entire list of trailers, I think there was 10 in total. There was actually maybe only one game that was brand new. Everything else had been already announced or we'd seen before. So that was disappointing on that front. But stuff that stood out for me, definitely for your listeners, if they've heard of this game, they know how excited the gaming community is. It's called Kena, Bridge of Spirits. This is a brand new kind of IP or kind of a brand new kind of game that hasn't been, you know, it's not a sequel, it's not a remake, it's a brand new kind of concept. And it's coming to PS5 and PS4, if I recall correctly, on August 24th. And that's what the big, you know, last night, the trailer on Thursday night showed us a launch date finally, because this game was originally meant to come out the end of last year with the PS5, I think, when it launched. But it was pushed back due to the pandemic. But now we finally have a release date and it looks, I know we keep throwing this around for these kind of CGI games, such as like Ratchet and Clank and whatnot, but this really looks like an interactive Disney animation or a Pixar movie. Like, it was just stunning to look at, really imaginative character design and world building. And yeah, it may not be like a 50, 60 hour game, because I think it's coming in at maybe €40, meaning it'll be, you know, you won't be getting a massively long or kind of, you know, many hours of gameplay, but still from what I've seen, it looks absolutely stunning. So that's one I'm actually genuinely really excited about.
And so some of them, because the comment that I got here at home from my boyfriend who was watching was that, just kind of what you said there now, that this is either remakes of remakes or mini twists on stuff that we already have or stuff that we knew was coming down the tracks. So was there any big titles in the mix that we'd even be remotely excited by?
God, not like, as your boyfriend rightfully said, it was either remakes or just kind of PS4 titles getting a boost to PS5 graphics and processing power. So I think, you know, the show kind of wrapped up with Final Fantasy VII, which was a huge success last year for the PS4 owners. It was a remake in itself from, a game from 1997 on the original PS1. So now we're getting a PS5 version, which will have even prettier visuals and also kind of a new character that you'll be able to kind of purchase if needs be. People that own the PS4 version of the game will be able to upgrade for free, but then there's a lot of kind of caveats of, you know, if you have this version and the digital version, you can't get the disc version, and it gets very convoluted very quickly. But it does look visually, you know, amazing for kind of a showcase piece for the PS5. But it's mad to see such a recent game getting a kind of an overhaul so quickly. But they know that the audience is there, the demographic is there, and the fan base for this Final Fantasy title, so they're going to cash in when they can. Otherwise, there was one other title that stood out to me. It's a bit more kind of indie looking. It's called Sifu, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, S-I-F-U. And it looks like a modern kind of 3D take on your kind of beat 'em up games. But you're kind of, it looks like it's inspired by Jackie Chan titles, you know, proper kung fu, you know, action, you know, close quarters combat sort of stuff. And just from the little glimpse we saw, you know, at the events, you could actually see the weight in the character's arms as he was kind of going through the motions. And I know that sounds a bit silly, but when you see the trailer online, you kind of see what I mean, that the character has like actual mass to him when he's punching and he's kicking, and it looks really like it's something you wouldn't register until you actually see it developed into the game itself. And I think it's something to, you know, we don't have a release date just yet. We know it's coming this year, but we I'm really excited to learn more. As I said, Sifu, S-I-F-U, if your listeners are interested.
I'm interested though that they held this event, but there's no real, like usually there's been events that you've been at before and I've been at before, and we're kind of dying to get into the studio and tell each other about what we saw and what's coming. This one just seems a bit meh. Like, is it a bit of a missed opportunity from PlayStation's point of view to have their first big launch after the arrival of the PS5 and have no great takeaways?
Yeah, see, it's I think it's all going to be slightly anticlimactic no matter which way or the other. It's kind of a lose-lose, unfortunately. But like, you can't deliver every single time with the way things are. You know, gamers are one of the most eager and kind of information hungry audiences in the world. They want new, they want better, they want information as soon as it comes available, and they want to know what they're getting. But you know, with these kind of launch events, it's a tricky one to please everyone. Like, I'm kind of interested to see why they decided to go out now. Like, this week has been so busy for PlayStation in general. As I said, they mentioned their new PlayStation VR console is coming. They've already announced a launch date for one of the biggest kind of PS5 launch titles, or kind of launch window titles, in Ratchet and Clank, A Rift Apart. We know that's coming in June. That's a huge title. We also got word that the Gran Turismo 7, their kind of racing simulator game, has been pushed to next year. So they've been already seeding a lot of information that they could have potentially saved for this. So I'm kind of interested as to why they didn't, you know, go with the PSVR information for the end of the announcement, even though we don't know what the headset would look like. We know it is coming, and that got a lot of traction earlier in the week. So yeah, it's a bit of a weird messaging strategy for this week from PlayStation.
I remember when the initial PSVR came and I was so excited because it let me be Batman in my apartment, and I thought I was deadly. Do we anticipate, you know, more gaming titles to be available on PS4 and to be able to get more from it than previous?
On the PS4 console, do you mean?
With the new, whatever the new PSVR comes.
Well, I guess, like, we know that a handful of titles, not many now, have been upgraded to support the PS5. So anyone that had the PSVR and then also got a PS5 would have to send away for this little adapter, which is kind of poor planning, unfortunately, that to allow you to connect your PSVR camera or your PlayStation camera to the PS5. But that's just a side note. But other than that, we know that, you know, developer kits of this new headset that they're working on are being sent out to developers to let them create brand new PS5 titles for PSVR, if that makes sense. So I don't know how many more PS4 titles or PSVR titles for the current headset will be coming out. It'll be a handful, but not many, as developers start to kind of put their focus on this new headset that is expected to come out next year.
One of the big gaming stories we spoke about quite a bit before Christmas was the headaches with the Cyberpunk's game. It just didn't go down well. Do you think that's made some of the gaming title manufacturers a little bit cautious about setting, you know, specific targets and telling too much about games because they don't want to have the same experience themselves?
Yeah, like I'd be gobsmacked if not every single game developer or game publisher in the world didn't learn or didn't sit up and pay attention to what happened with Cyberpunk. It was that big of a deal. And I think it's a famous Miyamoto, the creator of Mario, the Nintendo god that he is, mentioned. He said, you know, a delayed game can be good, or again, I'm going to get this wrong now, but it's basically saying that a rushed game is always bad, but a delayed game can be good. I should really know that better off by heart, but it's true. Like it's much easier to delay it and then actually work on it, make sure it's you know, ready for the public, rather than rushing it for the investors or rushing it for the Christmas window, which seems to have what happened for Cyberpunk, and then just having this onslaught of errors and issues and glitches and bugs that just absolutely killed the game's reputation, and the company itself has been tarnished significantly. So yes, if I was a game developer, my game wasn't up to par, there's no way I'd be rushing it out just to hit a window to keep, as I said, stakeholders or shareholders happy, or to keep anyone else happy. I would want to make sure the game is as polished as possible before it went anywhere.
So are we still kind of humming and hawing about what's worth playing on the PS5? Like, I know friends of mine and colleagues of mine here in News Talk are still trying to get their hands on the new PS5. Was the hype, like, was it justified if, yes, the console is great and it can do brilliant things, but if you can't get the full benefit because there's not enough titles for it, you know, is there still a need to have that mad rush to want to get your hands on it?
Yeah, well, that's, again, it's really boils down to, like, yeah, it's want over need. Like, do you need it or do you want it? So if you want it, you're going to bend over backwards to get it. But really, there's still so many great titles that are on PS4. Like, a lot of the big ones, like the Spider-Man was a huge launch title for PS5, but that was also on PS4. I think, as I said, when we spoke about this previously, there's probably the first generation of a new console launch where you don't really need to have it on day one or have it in the first couple of months, because the real standout showpiece titles just aren't there as such as they used to be previously. So yeah, I guess it's a blessing in disguise in a weird way that they are hard to come by, or I don't know how to phrase that, but you're not really missing out massively if you're having difficulty getting it. So there's new games coming. This year will be a really strong year for PlayStation, there's no doubt about it. But if it's Christmas, if it really works out that, come this Christmas, that it's when you finally get your chance to get one, or someone gets it for you, or whatever happens, it arrives in your house, you haven't missed a huge amount, and you didn't have to wait then for the games to come out, because they will have launched throughout the year, if that makes sense. So you'll have a kind of a very busy Christmas in a really good way. Like, almost Christmas 2021 would have been more logical, seeing as a lot more games exclusives, be it Ratchet and Clank, be it in the next Horizon Forbidden West, or any of those kind of PS5 exclusives will finally have launched. Mm-hmm. Given the kind of delays from the pandemic, that this Christmas probably will be the best time to pick one up if you can, and if supply is there.
Do we have any update on the supply issue?
I see a lot of the kind of UK and Irish Twitter, gaming distributors and stores like Argos and GameStop stating, oh, we have units in, and then an hour later they're tweeting they're all sold out. I think it's something to do with the graphics card or the processor or semiconductors. It gets very technical, actually, on both the PS5 and the Xbox being in short supply. So it's not necessarily Sony's fault, as much as people want to blame them, that they can't get their hands on the console. It's the developers, the manufacturers of the actual processing chips that are put into the PlayStation that are in short demand. And there's rumors knocking about, I don't know how credible they are, that even President Biden has launched kind of an investigation as to what the hell is happening with this delay. I see a lot of the gaming Twitter audiences saying, oh yeah, we're finally going to have a solution to our problem, that supply is going to ramp up. But I think there's a lot of underlying issues that is really kind of causing the delay, not just Sony not making them quick enough, basically, because they obviously would if they could.
And is there still, I haven't actually heard anybody talking about the new Xbox, like, at all. Was that just a bit of a flop, or is it just that people are getting on with it?
I think they're getting on with it. With January, I think January was a really successful month for the console in the UK, and I think in Ireland, but that could mainly boil down to that people couldn't get their hands on the PS5. But I don't want to be kind of negative in that light. But yeah, the Xbox, it's exclusive titles aren't standing out as much as they are for what PS5 have coming throughout this year. We know Halo is drip feeding, or the Halo's developer is drip feeding information about when what we can expect from that, which was originally meant to come out, with the launch of the console in November, but now we know it's coming out this Christmas. So a whole year later of a delay, or even more than a year. And, some screenshots are coming out, very, very small information. And, that's a console seller, but otherwise this, it's a long lead for the Xbox community, or a long waiting time for them to get their true standout exclusives, because they have all been announced, but no set launch dates have been locked in, apart from the Halo, as I said, for this Christmas. The next Halo installment, should I say, Halo Infinite. As you said, we should hopefully see one of your favorite racing games, Forza Horizon, have a sequel coming, but God, that could be years away. We know that the developer for that game is working on a Fable reboot, one of the most successful franchises on the old and Xbox 360, original Xbox days. So they're busy as it is on a different title. But yeah, it's the Xbox just doesn't have the exclusives like PlayStation, so people aren't talking about it as much, unfortunately.
Final question. Somebody asked me on Instagram during the week, do we have any news from Nintendo? Are we going to see a new Switch console this year?
As much as I personally, and a lot of the, obviously the game, like that sold about 80 million units. It's en route, it's on a path to overtake the PS4 and being one of the most successful home consoles of all time. Like, it's stupidly successful. So yes, you know, gamers want a more powerful one to compete with the, you know, a 4K ready one that can compete with the likes of even the PS4 Pro, never mind the PS5 or even the Xbox One X. But I think Nintendo have come out and said, don't get your hopes up. They could be playing, bluffing us that, you know, come June or come July, we get a massive launch event where we can see the Nintendo Switch Pro being announced. But I think they're making too much money as it is off the current Switch to be rushing into a 4K model or a Pro model right now. But I hoped that I can be proven wrong.
Rightio. John Riley, the editor of TheEffect.net, will be back with us soon with more gaming news. If you do have any questions or if you want a review of a specific title, email techtalk@newstalk.com and hopefully John will oblige. John, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks, Jess.
Tech Talk. Tech Talk. Rate and subscribe.
TechTalk@newstalk.com is the email address if you'd like to get in touch with the show, or you'll find me on Twitter @JessKellyNT. We're going to talk about electricity now, of all things. And I'm delighted to be joined by Susan White from Electric Ireland to talk about a new initiative that they launched earlier this week. Susan, you're very welcome to the show. You might just start by telling us a little bit about your role within the company. Susan, you're very welcome to Tech Talk. You might just start by telling us a little bit about your role. What exactly is it that you do?
Yeah, thanks, Jess. So, look, delighted to be here today. I'm the Smart Metering Programme Manager in Electric Ireland. I suppose as part of the rollout of smart meters in Ireland, electricity suppliers have set up programmes to start delivering new services to customers with smart meters. So I'm in the lucky position of managing that programme in Electric Ireland. And today's an exciting day. Today, the systems that allow electricity suppliers like Electric Ireland offer these new services to customers with smart meters, they go live. So I suppose it's about as exciting as it gets in the electricity industry today. I know that can be challenging for anybody to understand. It's something we've been working towards for the last couple of years, and we're really delighted to be able to launch these services that, we've talked, Jess, to, I suppose, over 1,000 householders in Ireland to try and understand what kind of new services they would like. So really excited to be able to offer them to Electric Ireland customers with smart meters from today.
So just start by explaining a little bit about what a smart meter is then, because we hear the word smart being put in front of a whole host of things. Obviously, people know about smartphones, know about smart TVs. What is a smart meter and how exactly does it work?
Yeah, a really good question. So a smart meter, I suppose, is like the next generation electricity meter using digital technology and the 2G network. So what does that mean, right? So if you compare it to the electricity meter that most of us have in our home, there's a few important differences between the smart meter and our current meter. So the first thing, I suppose, is at the moment, most people's meters are read twice a year, and then there's an estimated read done the other four of the times during the year. So if you like, there's six readings taken from the meter, and they're used then to bill a customer. So with a smart meter, there's no more estimated reads, Jeff. So it's all based on actual reads. And then the other difference is that it's actually read remotely using the 2G network. So no more, I suppose, going out to read a meter, or if the meter is in an awkward spot and hard to read, that's no longer a problem. So I suppose that's one important difference. The other important difference is that the meter is actually able to record data a little bit more granularly, right? So that enables suppliers to offer a better range of services to customers. So if you take your meter at the moment, as I said, there are six readings collected per year. With a smart meter, with a customer's consent, it can actually record 48 readings a day, so a reading every half hour. And what that allows is for electricity suppliers to receive that, like Electric Ireland, and then play that back to customers to try and give insights and let customers understand their energy consumption better. So what I mean by that is we'd be able to show you what electricity you're using when, and also what appliances are driving that electricity use. So what you might see is that your laundry is actually taking up quite a big part of your electricity usage in your home. And you may decide, well, look, that's life and I need to do the laundry and I'm happy with that. Or you may decide to reduce that. You might find your refrigeration or your heating is actually driving a large part of your bill. So what's really interesting from a customer's point of view is that it's the first time they get to see that, you know. So when we talk to customers, that was a big frustration or challenge, you know, that, you know, you weren't able you had your bill coming every 2 months and you weren't able to work out what exactly was driving that up or down, you know. So I suppose the smart meters are allowing us to be able to offer that service to customers so that they can understand the consumption better and they can reduce that, Jess, or I suppose we can also offer new price plans that offer cheaper electricity at different times. So armed with that knowledge, a customer can decide to move when they're using their electricity. And I suppose with us all working from home a bit more now, or a few of us working from home a bit more now, myself included, you can move your electricity consumption a little bit earlier or easier to different times during the day and make some savings there as well.
Yeah, I'm interested because accuracy is a good thing. And so being able to get that level of data on what is using the most amount of power and so on is brilliant. But with more of us working from home, i.e. we have no choice but to use more power, does this mean then that we're actually going to be charged more than if it was based off estimated readings?
No, actually, it's not, Jess. It actually empowers customers to use less and to move it to a cheaper time. So, for example, if I give you an example of one of the price plans, Night Boost, it has a cheaper night rate, okay? So after a period in the evening, it's actually cheaper to use your electricity, like significantly cheaper. So with you being at home, you could decide, you know what, I'm going to do that laundry later on tonight, or I'm going to prep some food for tomorrow, tonight, okay? So you get an opportunity there to move your usage around because you know what's driving that usage. So you'll be able to work out what, as I say there, I'm using laundry all the time. It's on my mind at the moment. I'm doing laundry at the moment. You know, so it allows customers to actually save money, Jess. And really it's about empowering customers. You know, you have the information, you can choose to use it or not, you know. So you can, as I said earlier, you can choose to say, okay, well, look, that's what I need to use in my house to be comfortable. And my priority is for everybody to be comfortable. Or you can look at ways of reducing the consumption of certain appliances by using them less.
Yeah, it's something that I'm really interested in because I am an absolute divil. And I know if Dublin Fire Brigade listen to this, they're going to give out to me. But I am notorious for leaving stuff plugged in or leaving stuff on standby, never really giving much consideration to the energy that's being used to kind of keep that in that standby mode or keep it on sleep mode or whatever it is. Is that something that I think that's one of the benefits that maybe user habits might improve for a whole host of reasons?
Yeah, absolutely. So you'd be able to see that if you like always on level of power and I'm guilty myself, Jess, you know, I do it myself. You know, the TV gets left plugged in and different things, you know, get left plugged in overnight. So customers will be able to see that, you know. I suppose some of the other things that smart meters enable, Jess, is that customers are able to choose what day they want their electricity bill on, you know. So having the more granular data allows suppliers to bill a customer on the date that they choose. So Electric Ireland are letting customers choose if they want monthly billing and what day they would like the bill to be created on, you know. So that gives more flexibility there. The other thing that we can do is give, if customers want it, bill alerts. So that bill shock is a thing of the past, you know, where a customer will know if they want on a weekly basis, you know, if I keep using electricity at this level, my bill is looking like this at the end of the month or at the end of the bi-monthly period. So it really gives customers a lot more information and empowers them then, if you like, to reduce their carbon footprint if they want to use less or to move it to a time where electricity is cheaper, you know, on the grid or more renewable power is being produced on the grid.
So we've heard about the benefits from the consumer side. What are the benefits from Electric Ireland side or any of the energy providers who might be going down this route? What are the benefits from the business point of view?
Yeah, so again, I suppose it's quite similar, Jess, in that I suppose reducing energy consumption is good for us all, is good for the environment. Electric Ireland are obviously the largest electricity supplier in the market, and we really want to be a leader in this area and to encourage our customers to reduce their electricity usage. As I say, it all adds up to a better story for the environment and a better impact on the environment. And I suppose that's really where we're coming from with this, and I suppose giving customers that knowledge, letting them make the choice, really helps reduce the carbon footprint. And as I say, it's really putting it into customers' hands, whether they want to do something about it or not, but we're giving them the information to allow them to do that.
Again, sticking with the company, how big an investment was this undertaking? Because I'm sure that there's infrastructure, there's servers, there's software, there's a million and one things that go along with this. So it must have been a big project from your side.
Yeah, I mean, you're right, Jess. It's a significant project, and it's something that Electric Ireland thought was very important to invest in. And when I say invest in, I'm talking about people, expertise, and time as well. So I'm the program manager. There's a very large team that have been working on this. I'm very, very lucky with the team that I have in place, very much a can-do, will-do attitude on the project, very flexible team. We've been working on this for 2 years, Jess, and working towards this. I talked about the research that we did with customers and really wanting to address that in the new service that we're offering. You know, a big part of this is offering it via our digital platform, so our RES portal, via your online account. So customers will be able to log in there, sign up for these new services, and be able to see their information on a daily basis update there on their online account. So yeah, a lot of work has gone into making these services available from today.
And so if people do want it, like, what changes do they have to make? You mentioned there about the online portal. Is it that a particular device gets installed, or how does that work?
No, so it's really, really easy, Jess. The smart meter has been installed by ESB Network. So there are about 250,000 households in Ireland at the moment who have smart meters installed. And ESB Networks then will be continuing that rollout. They'll be installing about 500,000 meters every year for the next 4 years. So that's all you need. Okay, so once you have your smart meter in place, you contact Electric Ireland and you can log on to your online account and sign up there and then. It's very simple. And I talked there about, consent for the data. It's very much a customer choice. So we ask customers to opt in to give us their data so that we can offer those services. If a customer changes their mind at any time, so say, Jess, you decide in a year's time, I want to change my mind, or somebody moves into your house, for example, and doesn't want that level of data to flow for some reason, very easy to change that, so there's no issue there with customers signing up. It's very, very straightforward via the online portal. If people would prefer, they can call our call center, our team, and they can sign them up to the new smart services as well.
Is this the way things are going? So say if someone's buying a new house in the next few years, this will become the norm rather than new houses being built with the traditional meters?
Yeah, so any new connections at the moment, Jeff, a smart meter is going in to that house. So a new property or a new connection. And then, as I said, they're replacing all the other stock of electricity meters with smart meters over the next 4 years. So yeah, it'll be the standard meter that will be in everybody's home. And as I say, everybody with that smart meter will be able to avail of these new services. And if it suits them, the price plan. So another thing that we added, Jess, and a bit of feedback that we got from customers was, these new price plans, will they suit me? Will they not? And they really wanted advice in that area. So what we've included is every 6 months, based on your usage over the last 6 months, if there's a price plan that actually you would be better on or would make savings for you, we'll let you know. Again, it's up to you whether you choose to take that price plan or not, or stay on your existing price plan. But again, we're giving customers that knowledge. So for example, if you have bought an EV, our night boost price plan would really suit you because it has a very low night rate for charging your EV. And we also have a weekend plan. So if you do an awful lot of your electricity usage at the weekend, we have a plan that gives you free electricity on either a Saturday or a Sunday. You choose which day. you get on with doing everything that you want to do on that day. So again, if that type of plan suits you, we'll advise you of that every 6 months. And again, it's up to the customer whether they take that up or not. But really, it's all about empowering customers to understand how they're using electricity. And then if an alternative plan suits them, well, then they can move to that and they'll benefit with savings and the environment, I suppose, benefits as well.
Well, look, it does sound like a good idea. And I'm all about knowing that nitty gritty information. I'm a big fan of it. Susan White from Electric Ireland, thank you so much for your time. Full information is available up on electricireland.ie if you do want to find it out. But for now, Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you so much, Jess. Really appreciate it. Thank you.
And that is all we have time for this week. If you missed any of the show, you can listen back in full up on newstalk.com. But don't forget to subscribe to the podcast on the Newstalk app in iTunes, Pocket Casts, or wherever you get your podcasts from. John Fardy's up next here on Newstalk. I'll chat to you next week.